expressions of the culture of our time. In Berlin itself, compare the shameful disproportion between the buildings which belong to the Reich and those which have been erected for the accommodation of trade and finance. The credits that are voted for public buildings are in most cases inadequate and really ridiculous. They are not built as structures that were meant to last, but mostly for the purpose of answering the need of the moment. No higher idea influenced those who commissioned such buildings. At the time the Berlin Schloss was built, it had a quite different significance from what the new library has for our time, seeing that one battleship alone represents an expenditure of about 60 million marks, whereas less than half that sum was allotted for the building of the Reichstag, which is the most imposing structure erected for the Reich, and which should have been built to last for ages. Yet, in deciding the question of internal decoration, the upper house voted against the use of stone and ordered that the walls should be covered with stucco. For once, however, the parliamentarians made an appropriate decision on that occasion, for plaster heads would be out of place between stone walls. The community as such is not the dominant characteristic of our contemporary cities, and therefore it is not to be wondered at if the community does not find itself architecturally represented. Thus we must eventually arrive at a veritable civic desert, which will at last be reflected in the total indifference of the individual citizen towards his own country. This is also a sign of a cultural decay, a general break-up. Our era is entirely preoccupied with little things which are to no purpose, or rather it is entirely preoccupied in the service of money. Therefore it is not to be wondered at if, with the worship of such an idol, the sense of heroism should entirely disappear. But the present is only reaping what the past has sown. All these symptoms which preceded the final collapse of the Second Empire must be attributed to the lack of a definite and uniformly accepted Weltanschauung and the general uncertainty of outlook consequent on that lack. This uncertainty showed itself when the great questions of the time had to be considered one after another, and a decisive policy adopted towards them. This lack is also accountable for the habit of doing everything by halves, beginning with the educational system, the shilly-shally, the reluctance to undertake responsibilities, and finally, the cowardly tolerance of evils that were even admitted to be destructive. Visionary humanitarianisms became the fashion. In weakly submitting to these aberrations and sparing the feelings of the individual, the future of millions of human beings was sacrificed. An examination of the religious situation before the war shows that the general process of disruption had extended to this sphere also. A great part of the nation itself had for a long time already ceased to have any convictions of a uniform and practical character in their ideological outlook on life. In this matter, the point of primary importance was by no means the number of people who renounced their church membership, but rather the widespread indifference. While the two Christian denominations maintained missions in Asia and Africa, for the purpose of securing new adherents to the faith, these same denominations were losing millions and millions of their adherents at home, in Europe. These former adherents either gave up religion wholly as a directive force in their lives, or they adopted their own interpretation of it. The consequences of this were specially felt in the moral life of the country. In parenthesis, it may be remarked that the progress made by the missions in spreading the Christian faith abroad was only quite modest in comparison with the spread of Mohammedanism. It must be noted, too, that the attack on the dogmatic principles underlying ecclesiastical teaching increased steadily in violence. And yet this human world of ours would be inconceivable without the practical existence of a religious belief. The great masses of a nation are not composed of philosophers. For the masses of the people especially, faith is absolutely the only basis of a moral outlook on life. The various substitutes that have been offered have not shown any results that might warrant us in thinking that they might usefully replace the existing denominations. But if religious teaching and religious faith were once accepted by the broad masses as active forces in their lives, then the absolute authority of the doctrines of faith would be the foundation of all practical effort. There may be a few hundreds of thousands of superior men who can live wisely and intelligently without depending on the general standards that prevail in everyday life, but the millions of others cannot do so. Now the place which general custom fills in everyday life corresponds to that of general laws in the state and dogma in religion. The purely spiritual idea is of itself a changeable thing that may be subjected to endless interpretations. It is only through dogma that it is given a precise and concrete form without which it could not become a living faith. Otherwise, the spiritual idea would never become anything more than a mere metaphysical concept, or rather a philosophical opinion. Accordingly, the attack against dogma is comparable to an attack against the general laws on which the state is founded, and so this attack would finally lead to complete political anarchy if it were successful, just as the attack on religion would lead to a worthless religious nihilism. The political leader should not estimate the worth of a religion by taking some of its shortcomings into account, but he should ask himself whether there be any practical substitute in a view which is demonstrably better. Until such a substitute be available, only fools and criminals would think of abolishing the existing religion. Undoubtedly, no small amount of blame for the present unsatisfactory religious situation must be attributed to those who have encumbered the ideal of religion with purely material accessories, and have thus given rise to an utterly futile conflict between religion and science. In this conflict, victory will very nearly always be on the side of science, even though, after a bitter struggle, while religion will suffer heavily in the eyes of those who cannot penetrate beneath the mere superficial aspects of science. But the greatest damage of all has come from the practice of debasing religion as a means that can be exploited to serve political interests, or rather, commercial interests. The impudent and loud-mouthed liars who do this make their profession of faith before the whole world in stentorian tones, so that all poor mortals may hear. Not that they are ready to die for it if necessary, but rather that they may live all the better. They are ready to sell their faith for any political quid pro quo. For 10 parliamentary mandates they would ally themselves with the Marxists, who are the mortal foes of all religion. And for a seat in the cabinet they would go the length of wedlock with the devil, if the latter had still not retained some traces of decency.
File 57.
If religious life in pre-war Germany had a disagreeable savour for the mouths of many people, this was because Christianity had been lowered to base uses by political parties that called themselves Christian, and because of the shameful way in which they tried to identify the Catholic faith with a political party. This substitution was fatal. It procured some worthless parliamentary mandates for the party in question, but the church suffered damage thereby. The consequences of that situation had to be borne by the whole nation, for the laxity that resulted in religious life set in at a juncture when everything was beginning to lose hold and vacillate, and the traditional foundations of custom and of morality were threatening to fall asunder. Yet all those cracks and clefts in the social organism might not have been dangerous if no grave burdens had been laid upon it. But they became disastrous when the internal solidarity of the nation was the most important factor in withstanding the storm of big events. In the political field also, observant eyes might have noticed certain anomalies of the Reich, which foretold disaster unless some alteration and correction took place in time. The lack of orientation in German policy, both domestic and foreign, was obvious to everyone who was not purposely blind. The best thing that could be said about the practice of making compromises is that it seemed outwardly to be in harmony with Bismarck's axiom that politics is the art of the possible. But Bismarck was a slightly different man from the chancellors who followed him. This difference allowed the former to apply that formula to the very essence of his policy, while in the mouths of the others it took on an utterly different significance. When he uttered that phrase, Bismarck meant to say that in order to attain a definite political end, all possible means should be employed, or at least that all possibilities should be tried. But his successors see in that phrase only a solemn declaration that one is not necessarily bound to have political principles or any definite political aims at all. And the political leaders of the Reich at that time had no far-seeing policy. Here again, the necessary foundation was lacking, namely a definite Weltanschauung. And these leaders also lacked that clear insight into the laws of political evolution, which is a necessary quality in political leadership. Many people who took a gloomy view of things at that time condemned the lack of ideas and lack of orientation which were evident in directing the policy of the Reich. They recognized the inner weaknesses and futility of this policy. But such people played only a secondary role in politics. Those who had the government of the country in their hands were quite as indifferent to principles of civil wisdom laid down by thinkers like Houston, Stuart, Chamberlain, as our political leaders now are. These people are too stupid to think for themselves, and they have too much self-conceit to take from others the instruction which they need. Oxenstierna gave expression to a truth which has lasted since time immemorial, when he said that the world is governed by only a particle of wisdom. Almost every civil servant of councillor rank might naturally be supposed to possess only an atom or so belonging to this particle. But since Germany became a republic, even this modicum is wanting. And that is why they had to promulgate the law for the defence of the republic, which prohibits the holding of such views or expressing them. It was fortunate for Oxenstierna that he lived at that time, and not in this wise republic of our time. Already before the war, that institution which should have represented the strength of the Reich, the Parliament, the Reichstag, was widely recognized as its weakest feature. Cowardliness and fear of shouldering responsibilities were associated together there in a perfect fashion. One of the silliest notions that one hears expressed today is that in Germany the parliamentary institution has ceased to function since the revolution. This might easily be taken to imply that the case was different before the revolution. But in reality, the parliamentary institution never functioned except to the detriment of the country. And it functioned thus in those days when people saw nothing or did not wish to see anything. The German downfall is to be attributed in no small degree to this institution. But that the catastrophe did not take place sooner is not to be credited to the Parliament, but rather to those who opposed the influence of this institution, which, during peace times, was digging the grave of the German nation and the German Reich. From the immense mass of devastating evils that were due either directly or indirectly to the Parliament, I shall select one of the most intimately typical of this institution, which was the most irresponsible of all time. The evil I speak of was seen in the appalling shilly-shally and weakness in conducting the internal and external affairs of the Reich. It was attributable in the first place to the action of the Reichstag, and was one of the principal causes of the political collapse. Everything subject to the influence of Parliament was done by halves, no matter from what aspect you may regard it. The foreign policy of the Reich in the matter of alliances was an example of shilly-shally. They wished to maintain peace, but in doing so they steered straight into war. Their Polish policy was also carried out by half measures. It resulted neither in a German triumph nor Polish conciliation, and it made enemies of the Russians. They tried to solve the Alsace-Lorraine question through half measures. Instead of crushing the head of the French Hydra once and for all with a mailed fist and granting Alsace-Lorraine equal rights with other German states, they did neither the one nor the other. Anyhow, it was impossible for them to do otherwise, for they had among their ranks the greatest traitors to the country, such as Herr Wetterle of the Centre Party. But still the country might have been able to bear with all this, provided the half-measure policy had not victimized that force in which, as the last resort, the existence of the empire depended, namely, the army. The crime committed by the so-called German Reichstag in this regard was sufficient of itself to draw down upon it the curses of the German nation for all time. On the most miserable of pretexts, these parliamentary party henchmen filched from the hands of the nation and threw away the weapons which were needed to maintain its existence, and therewith defend the liberty and independence of our people. If the graves on the plains of Flanders were to open today, the blood-stained accusers would arise, hundreds and thousands of our best German youth, who were driven into the arms of death by those conscienceless parliamentary ruffians who were either wrongly educated for their task, or only half-educated. Those youths, and other millions of the killed and mutilated, were lost to the fatherland simply and solely in order that a few hundred deceivers of the people might carry out their political manoeuvres and their exactions, or even treasonably pursue their doctrinaire theories. by means of the Marxist and democratic press, the Jews spread the colossal falsehood about German militarism throughout the world and tried to inculpate Germany by every possible means, while at the same time the Marxist and democratic parties refused to assent to the measures that were necessary for the adequate training of our national defence forces. The appalling crime thus committed by these people ought to have been obvious to everybody who foresaw that in case of war the whole nation would have to be called to arms, and that because of the mean huckstering of these noble representatives of the people, as they called themselves, millions of Germans would have to face the enemy ill-equipped and insufficiently trained. But even apart from the consequences of the crude and brutal lack of conscience which these parliamentarian rascals displayed, it was quite clear that the lack of properly trained soldiers at the beginning of a war would most probably lead to the loss of such a war. And this probability was confirmed in a most terrible way during the course of the World War. Therefore, the German people lost the struggle for the freedom and independence of their country because of the half-hearted and defective policy employed during times of peace in the organization and training of the defensive strength of the nation. The number of recruits trained for the land forces was too small, but the same half-heartedness was shown in regard to the navy, and made this weapon of national self-preservation more or less ineffective. Unfortunately, even the naval authorities themselves were contaminated with this spirit of half-heartedness. The tendency to build the ship on the stocks somewhat smaller than that just launched by the British did not show much foresight and less genius. A fleet which cannot be brought to the same numerical strength as that of the probable enemy ought to compensate for this inferiority by the superior fighting power of the individual ship. It is the weight of the fighting power that counts, and not any sort of traditional quality. As a matter of fact, modern technical development is so advanced and so well proportioned among the various civilized states that it must be looked on as practically impossible for one power to build vessels which would have a superior fighting quality to that of the vessels of equal size built by the other powers. But it is even less feasible to build vessels of smaller displacement, which will be superior in action to those of larger displacement. As a matter of fact, the smaller proportions of the German vessels could be maintained only at the expense of speed and armament. The phrase used to justify this policy was in itself an evidence of the lack of logical thinking on the part of the naval authorities who were in charge of these matters in times of peace. They declared that the German guns were definitely superior to the British 30.5 centimetre as regards striking efficiency. But that was just why they should have adopted the policy of building 30.5 centimetre guns also, for it ought to have been their object not to achieve equality, but superiority in fighting strength. If that were not so, then it would have been superfluous to equip the land forces with 42 centimetre mortars, for the German 21 centimetre mortar could be far superior to any high-angle guns which the French possessed at that time, and since the fortresses could probably have been taken by means of 30.5 centimetre mortars. The army authorities unfortunately failed to do so. If they refrain from assuring superior efficiency in the artillery as in the velocity, this was because of the fundamentally false principle of risk, which they adopted. The naval authorities, already in times of peace, renounced the principle of attack and thus had to follow a defensive policy from the very beginning of the war. But by this attitude they renounced also the chance of final success, which can be achieved only by an offensive policy. A vessel with slower speed and weaker armament will be crippled and battered by an adversary that is faster and stronger and can frequently shoot from a favourable distance. A large number of cruisers have been through bitter experiences in this matter. How wrong were the ideas prevalent among the naval authorities in times of peace was proved during the war. They were compelled to modify the armament of the old vessels and to equip the new ones with better armament whenever there was a chance to do so. If the German vessels in the Battle of the Skagerrak had been of equal size, the same armament and the same speed as the English, the British fleet would have gone down under the tempest of the German 38-centimetre shells, which hit their aims more accurately and were more effective. Japan had followed a different kind of naval policy. There, care was principally taken to create with every single new vessel a fighting force that would be superior to those of the eventual adversaries. But because of this policy, it was afterwards possible to use the fleet for the offensive. While the army authorities refused to adopt such fundamentally erroneous principles, the navy, which unfortunately had more representatives in Parliament, succumbed to the spirit that ruled there. The navy was not organized on a strong basis, and it was later used in an unsystematic and irresolute way. The immortal glory which the navy won, in spite of these drawbacks, must be entirely credited to the good work and the efficiency and incomparable heroism of officers and crews. If the former commanders-in-chief had been inspired with the same kind of genius, all the sacrifices would not have been in vain.
File 58.
It was probably the very parliamentarian skill displayed by the chief of the navy during the years of peace, which later became the cause of the fatal collapse, since parliamentarian considerations had begun to play a more important role in the construction of the navy than fighting considerations. The irresolution, the weakness, and the failure to adopt a logically consistent policy, which is typical of the parliamentary system, contaminated the naval authorities. As I have already emphasized, the military authorities did not allow themselves to be led astray by such fundamentally erroneous ideas. Ludendorff, who was then a colonel in the general staff, led a desperate struggle against the criminal vacillations with which the Reichstag treated the most vital problems of the nation, and in most cases voted against them. If the fight which this officer then waged remained unsuccessful, this must be debited to the Parliament, and partly also to the wretched and weak attitude of the Chancellor, Bethmann Hollweg. Yet those who are responsible for Germany's collapse do not hesitate now to lay all the blame on the shoulders of the one man who took a firm stand against the neglectful manner in which the interests of the nation were managed. But one falsehood more or less makes no difference to these congenital tricksters. Anybody who thinks of all the sacrifices which this nation has had to bear as a result of the criminal neglect of those irresponsible individuals, anybody who thinks of the number of those who died or were maimed unnecessarily, Anybody who thinks of the deplorable shame and dishonour which has been heaped upon us, and of the illimitable distress into which our people are now plunged, anybody who realizes that in order to prepare the way to a few seats in Parliament for some unscrupulous place-hunters and arrivists, will understand that such hirelings can be called by no other name than that of rascal and criminal. For otherwise, those words could have no meaning. In comparison with traitors who betrayed the nation's trust, every other kind of twister may be looked upon as an honourable man. It was a peculiar feature of the situation that all the real faults of the old Germany were exposed to the public gaze only when the inner solidarity of the nation could be injured by doing so. Then, indeed, unpleasant truths were openly proclaimed in the ears of the broad masses, while many other things were at times shamefully hushed up, or their existence simply denied, especially at times when an open discussion of such problems might have led to an improvement in their regard. The higher government authorities knew little or nothing of the nature and use of propaganda in such matters. Only the Jew knew that by an able and persistent use of propaganda, heaven itself can be presented to the people as if it were hell, and, vice versa, the most miserable kind of life can be presented as if it were paradise. The Jew knew this, and acted accordingly. But the German, or rather his government, did not have the slightest suspicion of it. During the war, the heaviest of penalties had to be paid for that ignorance. Over against the innumerable drawbacks which I have mentioned here, and which affected German life before the war, there were many outstanding features on the positive side. If we take an impartial survey, we must admit that most of our drawbacks were in great measure prevalent also in other countries and among the other nations, and very often in a worse form than with us, whereas among us there were many real advantages which the other did not have. The leading phase of Germany's superiority arose from the fact that, almost alone among all the other European nations, the German nation had made the strongest effort to preserve the national character of its economic structure, and for this reason was less subject than other countries to the power of international finance, though indeed there were many untoward symptoms in this regard also. And yet this superiority was a perilous one, and turned out later to be one of the chief causes of the World War. But even if we disregard this advantage of national independence in economic matters, there were certain other positive features of our social and political life which were of outstanding excellence. These features were represented by three institutions which were constant sources of regeneration. In their respective spheres, they were models of perfection, and were partly unrivalled. The first of these was the statal form as such, and the manner in which it had been developed for Germany in modern times. Of course, we must accept those monarchs who, as human beings, were subject to the failings which afflict this life and its children. If we were not so tolerant in these matters, then the case of the present generation would be hopeless. For if we take into consideration the personal capabilities and character of the representative figures in our present regime, it would be difficult to imagine a more modest level of intelligence and moral character. If we measure the value of the German Revolution by the personal worth length and calibre of the individuals whom this revolution has presented to the German people since November 1918, then we may feel ashamed indeed in thinking of the judgment which posterity will pass on these people, when the law for the protection of the Republic can no longer silence public opinion. Coming generations will surely decide that the intelligence and integrity of our new German leaders were in adverse ratio to their boasting and their vices. It must be admitted that the monarchy had become alien in spirit to many citizens, and especially the broad masses. This resulted from the fact that the monarchs were not always surrounded by the highest intelligence, so to say, and certainly not always by persons of the most upright character. Unfortunately, many of them preferred flatterers to honest-spoken men, and hence received their information from the former. This was a source of grave danger at a time when the world was passing through a period in which many of the old conditions were changing, and when this change was affecting even the traditions of the court. The average man or woman could not have felt a wave of enthusiasm surging within the breast when, for example, at the turn of the century, a princess in uniform and on horseback had the soldiers file past her on parade. Those high circles had apparently no idea of the impression which such a parade made on the minds of ordinary people, else such unfortunate occurrences would not have taken place. The sentimental humanitarianism, not always very sincere, which was professed in those high circles, was often more repulsive than attractive. When, for instance, the Princess X condescended to taste the products of a soup kitchen and found them excellent, as usual, such a gesture might have made an excellent impression in times long past. But on this occasion it had the opposite effect to what was intended. For even if we take it for granted that Her Highness did not have the slightest idea that on the day she sampled it, the food was not quite the same as on other days, it sufficed that the people knew it. Even the best of intentions thus became an object of ridicule or a cause of exasperation. Descriptions of the proverbial frugality practiced by the monarch, his much too early rise in the morning and the drudgery he had to go through all day long until late at night, and especially the constantly expressed fears lest he might become undernourished. All this gave rise to ominous expression on the part of the people. Nobody was keen to know what and how much the monarch ate or drank. Nobody grudged him a full meal or the necessary amount of sleep. Everybody was pleased when the monarch, as a man and a personality, brought honour on his family and his country, and fulfilled his duties as a sovereign. All the legends which were circulated about him helped little, and did much damage.
File 59.
These and such things, however, are only mere bagatelles. What was much worse was the feeling, which spread throughout large sections of the nation, that the affairs of the individual were being taken care of from above, and that he did not need to bother himself with them. As long as the government was really good, or at least moved by goodwill, no serious objections could be raised. But the country was destined to disaster when the old government, which had at least striven for the best, became replaced by a new regime which was not of the same quality. Then the docile obedience and infantile credulity which formerly offered no resistance was bound to be one of the most fatal evils that can be imagined. But against these and other defects, there were certain qualities which undoubtedly had a positive effect. First of all, the monarchical form of government guarantees stability in the direction of public affairs and safeguards public offices from the speculative turmoil of ambitious politicians. Furthermore, the venerable tradition which this institution possesses arouses a feeling which gives weight to the monarchical authority. Beyond this, there is the fact that the whole corps of officials, and the army in particular, are raised above the level of political party obligations. And still another positive feature was that the supreme rulership of the state was embodied in the monarch as an individual person who could serve as the symbol of responsibility, which a monarch has to bear more seriously than any anonymous parliamentary majority. Indeed, the proverbial honesty and integrity of the German administration must be attributed chiefly to this fact. Finally, the monarchy fulfilled a high cultural function among the German people, which made amends for many of its defects. The German residential cities have remained, even to our time, centres of that artistic spirit which now threatens to disappear and is becoming more and more materialistic. The German princes gave a great deal of excellent and practical encouragement to art and science, especially during the 19th century. Our present age certainly has nothing of equal worth. During that process of disintegration, which was slowly extending throughout the social order, the most positive force of resistance was that offered by the army. This was the strongest source of education which the German people possessed. For that reason, all the hatred of our enemies was directed against the paladin of our national self-preservation and our liberty. The strongest testimony in favour of this unique institution is the fact that it was derided, hated and fought against, but also feared by worthless elements all round. The fact that the international profiteers who gathered at Versailles, further to exploit and plunder the nations, directed their enmity specially against the old German army, proved once again that it deserved to be regarded as the institution which protected the liberties of our people against the forces of the International Stock Exchange. If the army had not been there to sound the alarm and stand on guard, the purposes of the Versailles representatives would have been carried out much sooner. There is only one word to express what the German people owe to this army. Everything. It was the army that still inculcated a sense of responsibility among the people when this quality had become very rare, and when the habit of shirking every kind of responsibility was steadily spreading. This habit had grown up under the evil influences of Parliament, which was itself the very model of irresponsibility. The army trained the people to personal courage at a time when the virtue of timidity threatened to become an epidemic, and when the spirit of sacrificing one's personal interests for the good of the community was considered as something that amounted almost to weak-mindedness. At a time when only those were estimated as intelligent who knew how to safeguard and promote their own egotistic interests, the army was the school through which individual Germans were taught not to seek the salvation of their nation in the false ideology of international fraternization between Negroes, Germans, Chinese, French and English, etc., but in the strength and unity of their own national being. The army developed the individual's powers of resolute decision, and this at a time when a spirit of indecision and scepticism governed human conduct. At a time when the wiseacres were everywhere setting the fashion, it needed courage to uphold the principles that any command is better than none. This one principle represents a robust and sound style of thought, of which not a trace would have been left in the other branches of life if the army had not furnished a constant rejuvenation of this fundamental force. A sufficient proof of this may be found in the appalling lack of decision which our present government authorities display. They cannot shake off their mental and moral lethargy and decide on some definite line of action, except when they are forced to sign some new dictate for the exploitation of the German people. In that case, they decline all responsibility, while at the same time they sign everything which the other side places before them, and they sign with all the readiness of an official stenographer. Their conduct is here explicable on the ground that in this case they are not under the necessity of coming to a decision, for the decision is dictated to them. The army imbued its members with a spirit of idealism and developed their readiness to sacrifice themselves for their country and its honour, while greed and materialism dominated in all other branches of life. The army united a people who were split up into classes, and in this respect had only one defect, which was the 1 year military service, a privilege granted to those who had passed through the high schools. It was a defect because the principle of absolute equality was thereby violated, and those who had a better education were thus placed outside the cadres to which the rest of their comrades belonged. The reverse would have been better. Since our upper classes were really ignorant of what was going on in the body corporate of the nation, and were becoming more and more estranged from the life of the people, the army would have accomplished a very beneficial mission if it had refused to discriminate in favour of the so-called intellectuals, especially within its own ranks. It was a mistake that this was not done. But in this world of ours, can we find any institution that has not at least one defect? And in the army, the good features were so absolutely predominant that the few defects it had were far below the average that generally arises from human weakness. But the greatest credit which the army of the old empire deserves is that, at a time when the person of the individual counted for nothing, and the majority was everything, it placed individual personal values above majority values. By insisting on its faith in personality, the army opposed that typically Jewish and democratic apotheosis of the power of numbers. The army trained what at that time was most surely needed, namely, real men. In a period when men were falling prey to effeminacy and laxity, 350,000 vigorously trained young men went from the ranks of the army each year to mingle with their fellow men. In the course of their 2 years' training, they had lost the softness of their young days and had developed bodies as tough as steel. The young man who had been taught obedience for 2 years was now fitted to command. The trained soldier could be recognized already by his walk. This was the great school of the German nation, and it was not without reason that it drew upon its head all the bitter hatred of those who wanted the empire to be weak and defenceless, because they were jealous of its greatness, and were themselves possessed by a spirit of rapacity and greed. The rest of the world recognized a fact which many Germans did not wish to see, either because they were blind to facts, or because, out of malice, they did not wish to see it. This fact was that the German army was the most powerful weapon for the defense and freedom of the German nation, and the best guarantee for the livelihood of its citizens. There was a third institution of positive worth, which has to be placed beside that of the monarchy and the army, and this was the civil service. German administration was better organized and better carried out than the administration of other countries. There may have been objections to the bureaucratic routine of the officials, but from this point of view the state of affairs was similar, if not worse, in other countries. But the other states did not have the wonderful solidarity which this organization possessed in Germany, nor were their civil servants of that same high level of scrupulous honesty. It is certainly better to be a trifle over-bureaucratic and honest and loyal than to be over-sophisticated and modern, the latter often implying an inferior type of character and also ignorance and inefficiency. For if it be insinuated today that the German administration of the pre-war period may have been excellent, so far as bureaucratic technique goes, but that from the practical business point of view it was incompetent, I can only give the following reply. What other country in the world possessed a better organized and administered business enterprise than the German state railways, for instance? It was left to the revolution to destroy this standard organization until a time came when it was taken out of the hands of the nation and socialized, in the sense which the founders of the Republic had given to that word, namely, making it subservient to the international stock exchange capitalists who were the wire-pullers of the German Revolution. The most outstanding trait in the civil service and the whole body of the civil administration was its independence of the vicissitudes of government, the political mentality of which could exercise no influence on the attitude of the German state officials. Since the revolution, this situation has been completely changed. Efficiency and capability have been replaced by the test of party adherence, and independence of character and initiative are no longer appreciated as positive qualities in a public official. They rather tell against him. The wonderful might and power of the old empire was based on the monarchical form of government, the army, and the civil service. On these three foundations rested that great strength which is now entirely lacking, namely, the authority of the state. For the authority of the state cannot be based on the babbling that goes on in Parliament, or in the provincial diets, and not upon laws made to protect the state, or upon sentences passed by the law courts to frighten those who have had the hardihood to deny the authority of the state, but only on the general confidence which the management and administration of the community establishes among the people. This confidence is, in its turn, nothing less than the result of an unshakable inner conviction that the government and administration of a country is inspired by disinterested and honest goodwill, and on the feeling that the spirit of the law is in complete harmony with the moral convictions of the people. In the long run, systems of government are not maintained by terrorism, but on the belief of the people in the merits and sincerity of those who administer and promote the public interests. though it be true that in the period preceding the war, certain grave evils tended to infect and corrode the inner strength of the nation, it must be remembered that the other states suffered even more than Germany from these drawbacks. And yet those other states did not fail and break down when the time of crisis came. If we remember further that those defects in pre-war Germany were outweighed by great positive qualities, we shall have to look elsewhere for the effective cause of the collapse. And elsewhere it lay. The ultimate and most profound reason of the German downfall is to be found in the fact that the racial problem was ignored, and that its importance in the historic development of nations was not grasped. For the events that take place in the life of nations are not due to chance, but are the natural results of the effort to conserve and multiply the species and the race, even though men may not be able consciously to picture to their minds the profound motives of their conduct.
File 60.
Chapter 11. Nation and Race. There are certain truths which stand out so openly on the roadsides of life, as it were, that every passer-by may see them. Yet because of their very obviousness, the general run of people disregard such truths, or at least they do not make them the object of any conscious knowledge. People are so blind to some of the simplest facts in everyday life that they are highly surprised when somebody calls attention to what everybody ought to know. Examples of the Columbus egg lie around us in hundreds of thousands, but observers like Columbus are rare. Walking about in the garden of nature, most men have the self-conceit to think that they know everything, yet almost all are blind to one of the most outstanding principles that nature employs in her work. This principle may be called the inner isolation, which characterizes each and every living species on this earth. Even a superficial glance is sufficient to show that all the innumerable forms in which the life urge of nature manifests itself are subject to a fundamental law. One may call it an iron law of nature, which compels the various species to keep within the definite limits of their own life forms when propagating and multiplying their kind. Each animal mates only with one of its own species. The titmouse cohabits only with the titmouse, the finch with the finch, the stork with the stork, the field mouse with the field mouse, the house mouse with the house mouse, the wolf with the she-wolf, etc. Deviations from this law take place only in exceptional circumstances. This happens especially under the compulsion of captivity, or when some other obstacle makes procreative intercourse impossible between individuals of the same species. But then nature abhors such intercourse with all her might, and her protest is most clearly demonstrated by the fact that the hybrid is either sterile or the fecundity of its descendants is limited. In most cases, hybrids and their progeny are denied the ordinary powers of resistance to disease or the natural means of defence against outer attack. Such a dispensation of nature is quite logical. Every crossing between two breeds, which are not quite equal, results in a product which holds an intermediate place between the levels of the two parents. This means that the offspring will indeed be superior to the parent which stands in the biologically lower order of being, but not so high as the higher parent.